Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who've always meant to watch classic movies. I'm your host, Nick Hayden.
And I'm your other host, Timothy Deal.
And we are in 1964 this time.
Wow. Amazing how this podcast allows us to time travel.
It's great. Yeah. Our other podcast lets us just travel interdimensionally.
Yes.
And this one is it easy or hard to go back in time?
Simpler, at least. At least we know what decade we're going to every episode.
Exactly. So this episode we are talking about...
A Fistful of Dollars.
So we're talking Clint Eastwood for the... Second time, I think. Okay. Oh, I was thinking ahead.
Yes, you are thinking ahead.
Yes.
But no, back in season one, we talked about Unforgiven, which I think will probably, it'll be interesting to compare Unforgiven with this movie, yes. Fistful of Dollars.
But before we get too far into the movie, Tim, it is the 60s. What is going on in movie history? Recap it for us.
Okay, last season in 1963, we talked about just a couple of things, because strangely enough, that was an Italian film we covered last season in the 60s.
Italian, well, it's filmed in Italy.
Is filmed in Italy, yes. It basically is an Italian film, but unlike 8 and a Half, which was always going to be an art house film, This movie was later marketed to a much wider audience. But let's recap the American side of things first real quick. Again, we're in kind of this in-between period of sorts. The American film industry, of course, is still competing with TV and other inexpensive forms of entertainment. The production code is still at least nominally around, but it has waning authority. Basically, there was a case in the late 50s that kind of established that film is considered free speech.
So they can do what they want.
They can do what they want, yeah, basically. And so that with loosening morals of the country, the production code has less and less authority.
And we're basically out of the golden age.
Yes.
Yes.
We are out of the golden age of Hollywood. Eventually, the production code would be completely replaced by the MPAA rating system, now just known as the MPA rating system, in 1968.
Okay, so coming up here.
Coming up, yes. We're still a couple years out from that. This is considered the early stages of New Hollywood, which would begin in earnest with Bonnie and Clyde in 1967. You've probably heard me say all that before. Yep. And while studios are trying to figure out their new normal, there are young audiences who are discovering fresh ideas in Japanese and European cinema, like Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa,
as 8 and a half, apparently.
Yeah, well, yeah, probably some 8 and a half. But also this movie, which we'll touch more on the timing of this movie, A Fistful of Dollars, here in just a minute. But before we go on to Italy, let's touch on some other notable things about here in America in 1964. The top grossing film of the year is Mary Poppins.
Ah, Mary Poppins. That's okay. Deserves it.
Yes. Right behind it, right on its heels, is My Fair Lady.
Wow, two musicals.
Yes, two musicals.
New Hollywood has not gripped the audiences yet.
Not necessarily. they still like something. Interestingly, number three, though, completely different kind of movie, Goldfinger.
Oh, okay.
So you got some James Bond.
So kind of blockbuster-ish.
Ish, yeah, yeah.
I mean, pre-blockbuster.
Basically, yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of events that really stood out to me among this, but the Academy Awards for this year, My Fair Lady and Mary Poppins were in the top stuff. My Fair Lady won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Rex Harrison.
Okay, yep.
Best Actress, though, went to Julie Andrews for Mary Poppins.
Okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's a very notable one.
Why didn't we watch those? Oh, we've seen those.
Exactly. And there's a funny story about, I don't know if you, have you heard of the story about Julie Andrews and My Fair Lady?
I don't know if I had, no, I don't think so.
Because she was in the Broadway version of My Fair Lady.
Oh, okay.
And then the Hollywood studios kind of skipped over her. They wanted a more established movie star to play Eliza Doolittle. So Walt Disney scooped her up instead. And I think she said in her, because it was Jack Warner who passed her up for the My Fair Lady part. And so in her acceptance speech, Julie Andrews thanked him specifically.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So fun stuff there. But yeah, our other nominations for this episode, it was a little tricky. One of our nominations was actually Goldfinger, because you said you didn't think you'd seen it.
At least not all. I've seen parts of it. Again, it's one of those things that just was on TV. You know?
Yeah.
And my grandpa's just always watching action movies on Sunday afternoon. Yeah.
Sure. It was very tempting to get at, well, one other time are we going to have a James Bond movie that's important enough to do it? And Goldfinger is like the seminal Sean Connery James Bond movie.
Yeah.
But we wanted, it was like, we should really get a spaghetti Western. And this is really our only Western of the season. And it's fun to compare it to previous ones that we've watched. Our other nomination for this episode was A Hard Day's Night, musical starring the Beatles. Yes.
Which I've seen Yellow Submarine, but not Hard Day's Night.
Yeah. A worthy nomination, but I think it's primarily known as a Beatles thing more than as a movie highlight. So
real quick, define in case people don't know, what is a spaghetti Western?
Sure. Spaghetti Western is a term for Westerns that are made in Italy.
Which was a big thing right around then, wasn't it?
Yeah. If you might remember from when we talked 8½ in 1964, we mentioned a thing called Hollywood on the Tiber, which is when a lot of Hollywood, big blockbuster Hollywood movies were filmed in Italy in the 1950s and early 1960s. And basically really inspired a certain style of Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood filmmaking style, like, was inspirational for the Italian filmmakers that they worked with. And some people think that that's, you know, helped inspire the spaghetti Westerns, which Italy is not the first European film to do their own Western set in the American West.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, like, European Westerns are as old as filmmaking itself. The Lumiere brothers had their first public screening of films in 1895. And already in 1896, Gabriel Verne shot Repast d'Indien, Indian Banquet, for the Lumiere brothers.
It's just the Western mythos was just rife for movies.
Yeah, which is not too surprising if you think about it. I mean, Peter Pan is a British story that has American Indians in it.
People were just fascinated with that.
Yeah, the world wide over, it was a huge fascination. So it's not surprised that Italy would want to do some and set in America of all places. But the term spaghetti Western itself really starts here with A Fistful of Dollars. I guess some scholars probably could be picky and point out some other Italian Westerns that made before this. But this one, A Fistful of Dollars, directed by Sergio Leone, really established the genre. And this is considered the first of a trilogy featuring Clint Eastwood as... Well, he became known in the marketing materials as the man with no name.
Yeah.
But it has been pointed out that in each one of these three movies, he has a name, or at least one that the townspeople call him, but it's a different name in each movie.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And this one, it's Joe, if you listen carefully enough. But is it really his name, or just what people choose to call him? Who knows? Anyway, but it's a certain... It has its own style of Western. Well, as we get into kind of pick this one apart, we'll talk a little bit more about what's different for this Western as opposed to ones that were more common in America.
Like Shane.
Yeah, like Shane or your John Wayne
or
John Ford directed Westerns. But I would say arguably the spaghetti Westerns really matched the times of the new Hollywood era that things were going into in terms of like more hard hitting, grittier.
A little more morally ambiguous.
Yeah, exactly. It really fit in with that whole thing that was happening worldwide at the time. Well, I don't know if we needed to go a whole lot deeper into history of Italian film. If you want to hear more about that, we had a nice rundown of that last season in the 8½ episode. I don't know that we need to repeat that here.
No, I think that's good.
So there you go.
All right, then are we ready for our summary, Tim?
I think so. So this movie, again, it stars Clint Eastwood as the man with no name. This is sort of his big breakout role. He had been in a popular TV show in the United States called Rawhide for a while.
Yep, heard that.
Rawhide, you probably heard the theme song, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But this was a different sort of project, and he said he was ready to play an anti-hero, which is sort of what this guy is. He shows up in a town called San Miguel on the Mexico-United States border. I think it seems to me it's supposed to be mostly in Mexico.
Yeah, I think we're mainly on the Mexican side.
Yeah, as far as I can tell. Turns out this town is being torn apart by two feuding families, gangs.
Smuggling gangs.
Basically both vying for supremacy, and the only business that is thriving in this town is the casket maker, because there's no respect for human life in this town. Our man with no name kind of enters into the middle of this. He's basically sort of a man for hire, and basically seems to have... I don't know, set himself up against both sides or work for both sides.
Or set
both sides against each other.
At least at first it seems for his own benefit and then for other reasons.
Yes. There is a family that's kind of caught in the crossfires between this. One of the gang leaders is a particularly brutal man who had got the wife...
Kidnapped the wife, basically.
Kidnapped the wife
for a
gambling death. Yeah, gambling debt, basically for himself. But the father and her son are still both in town and miss her terribly, and our man with no name helps them out some. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how much detail of the story we really want.
No, I think this is what you need. That he comes in and he pits them against each other, and then he's kind of the spark that lights the fire in the town.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, back in when I used to write these summaries out, we could get in more detail. But I think in terms of like the bare bones, like what you need to know.
That's what you need to know.
That's what you need to know for this one. As long as we're talking facts, this might be a good time to mention that this did come out in Italy in 1964, and it was a big success. However, it did not come to America until 1967.
Oh, really?
Part of that is because this is really an unofficial remake of an Akira Kurosawa film, Yojimbo,
okay,
from 1961. Apparently, Kurosawa himself wrote to the director, Leone, saying, "Signor Leone, I have just had the chance to see your film. It is a very fine film, but it is my film." And his company basically sued this company for rights.
Interesting.
And I think they settled out of court. Kurosawa and Toho, his studio, received 15% of the film's revenue.
That's interesting. We just watched Seven Samurai.
It is. Yeah. I did not know that history going into when we were planning out our season. But the difference between like Seven Samurai and Magnificent Seven is I think that was an official remake and this was not. And they kind of had to like, okay, here you go.
So if they had said that beforehand, it wouldn't be quite as much trouble.
Probably. Yeah. I think so. And if you look up on YouTube, A Fistful of Dollars versus Yojimbo, you'll see it's like, okay, yeah, here's some very similar beats. I think stylistically, I think you can point to some things that Sergio Leone is doing differently.
Yeah.
This is a shorter, tighter movie than what Kurosawa's is, from what I understand. And certainly filmmaking style is his own. But we can get into that more, I think, in our thoughts aspect.
Before we move forward then, mm-hmm. What awards or lasting impression do we have before we go into our own 12-minute speed run?
Interestingly, this was not popular with critics, or at least it had a very mixed reaction from critics when it came out. But that didn't keep it from being very...
He's kind of got in the popular zeitgeist to a certain extent.
Yeah, I was going to say, it didn't keep it from having a big influence. It was successful enough, they started making the sequel basically the following year.
The following year from when it was released in Italy or from when it was released in America?
From when it was released in Italy.
Okay.
The Fistful of Dollars is this year, 1964. The follow-up, For a Few Dollars More, was 1966. And so was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
But... partly because of the legal trauma with Toho is one reason why it was delayed coming to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So when it did, they released all three of those movies in 1967.
Oh, okay.
Starting with A Fistful of Dollars in January, the sequel in like May, and then the last one in December.
Oh, that was a movie event then, apparently.
Yeah.
I mean, you liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You kept coming back to see more of this guy. So yes, again, 1967, that's the same year of Bonnie and Clyde. So that's why I really say this really fed into the new Hollywood zeitgeist that was going on at the time. So yeah, I don't have any specific awards. I think because it's considered technically an Italian film is one reason why it's not on any AFI lists.
Okay, that would make sense.
Those are American Film Institute lists. But it established the style of a spaghetti Western, I think, very clearly in terms of like the music, the kind of characters that were involved. The music is probably the most distinctive thing to me, if you ask me. Like, I don't think I was real familiar with this style growing up because we watched a lot of Westerns, but all three of these movies are rated R. So it's not the sort of thing I would have watched growing up as a kid. And we'll discuss a little bit more of that, which I should note, I say it's rated R, but technically this would have come out before the MPA rating system. So it must have been like a...
Grandfathered in
later, like a second re-release or something. Yeah. So, but there you go. I think those are the facts you need to know for this thing.
All right. Then we got our 12 minutes.
Let me get that on the clock. Ready and go.
All right. So what do you want to start with?
Let's
angles here.
Well, I'll be a little honest. This is the first movie we had this season I feel a little mixed about. But let's start with the good and then we'll get into the bad and the ugly.
Yeah, sounds good.
So what was your favorite part of this?
My favorite part, I don't know, favorite. The style is interesting. The style is intriguing. It was very different than what we've been watching this season so far. You know, very close faces. It had some of that like, that Western, like, you look at everybody's face and the music in the background, and you're just kind of waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, way more whistles than I normally...
Lots of whistling, yeah. I'd say I really enjoyed the standoff at the end. Like, there's that sort of, yes, the bad guys got it.
Yeah.
That sort of, like, well, it's harsh justice, but it's justice sort of thing, which I guess I appeals to me to a certain extent.
Sure. I saw one reviewer point out, like, the opening credits have kind of an almost comic booky feel to it. I mean, I hadn't thought of it at the time, but it's very stylized, like, 60s kind of, like... Yeah. Silhouettes of gunfighters and all that kind of thing. And it really does like emphasize the shootout nature of this sort of story. And it's the kind of pulpy thing that the movie really wants you to lean into and enjoy.
Clint Eastwood's just that sharpshooter and can hit like five guys in half a second.
Right, right.
I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
Yeah, those are fun aspects of it. It is fun to have the bounty hunter. Like you said, it's the chaotic neutral guy.
He was chaotic neutral. Like, you're like, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be cheering for him or not, but he's going to kill the bad guy, so I'm good with this.
It is satisfying to see him basically play both sides against each other.
I guess this might go into the style thing. It's very interesting. In the first movie, I think we watched, not especially this season, but maybe all of them, where the main character, you really don't quite get his motivations.
Yeah, they really don't spend much time trying to get into his head at all.
And again, you can read them, not that they're not there, but it really is, he's kind of a blank slate to a certain extent.
Yeah.
From the audience's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not, he has reasons. You don't feel like he's a badly written character.
Sure.
But you just feel like you don't completely, you're like, he's doing it for the money. Is he doing it completely for the money? Is he doing the money and he's actually trying to wipe out, like, later on it gets more clear. Like, you can tell that he wants to help the girl and that he wants to punish the one family.
Yeah.
But
it's not even clear if that was always his original intention or if it's just one that he kind of fell into along the way.
Yeah, it almost feels like he fell into it. It's like he meant to just kind of play them off each other so he could make some money.
A fistful of dollars.
And then it became, well,
and
the only background or motivation you get at one point is like, I knew someone like you once.
Yeah.
It's like, I think the only personal detail we have.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting choice. And it works in this movie, but it's a little, I don't know if unsettling, but makes things uncertain.
Don Miguel Rojo, I want to talk to you. Don Miguel, I hear you're hiring on men. Well, I might just be available. I gotta tell you before you hire me. I don't work cheap.
And apparently this is a direction that Clint Eastwood really kind of pushed the character in. I guess early on he really wanted to take out as much dialogue. He was kind of fighting to take out dialogue to make him this more mysterious, enigmatic man. I think a little early side of his like directing. I don't think he had started directing yet at this point. But
I would guess that's one reason this has stuck with people, because it is a very compelling sort of character.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some people refer to him as almost like a punk rock new cowboy of sorts. Like,
yeah,
he's not the white hats. He's not the stalwart John Wayne that is, you know, the manly man is going to come down and lay down righteousness.
Either weird, like, just how his hair was sometimes, his grizzled look. He just reminded me of Wolverine occasionally.
Sure.
Which is somewhat his character, too. This sort of, like, he's vicious, but sometimes good.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's interesting if you compare him to Shane, who is nominally a very similar character, kind of an outsider.
And you don't know anything about him either.
A rougher background. And Shane even comes into town like wearing buckskins.
Yeah.
But Shane also looks a lot more clean shaven, even at the beginning.
His name's also Shane.
It's true. This is the man with no name.
Yeah. No, but they're similar mysterious men coming in town cleaning up. But Shane, you always felt like he didn't want to do something, but he was always on the good side. This guy comes in, you're not really sure. He doesn't seem like a bad guy, but he doesn't seem like a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, things you get in like Punisher or Yeah.
Wolverine is a good comparison,
yeah,
too.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. And you could certainly see how this influenced, well, other Clint Eastwood characters that would come after this, like Dirty Harry, for example. But he basically created an archetype. I don't know, created might be a strong word, but like pushed a certain version of one.
Yeah, he repackaged it for modern American, especially Western audiences, and that sort of, he's not quite an outlaw, but he's not a sheriff either.
Yeah.
We have never paid anybody so much. You cannot leave someone like that to do what he wants around here. He's capable of doing anything, and I want law and order in this place.
You know, you mentioned the close-ups earlier, and that was something that some people have referred to as part of Leone's style, like varying between these wide landscapey shots and these very tight close-ups. And part of me is like, well, isn't that what any movie maker does? But when I was thinking about it, it's like a lot of these close-ups were very like intense.
And they're very intensely close-up.
Not only in like how tight they are on the face, but in the way they're lighted and the amount of sweat and like lines and detail that are on these guys' faces in the middle of all this. I mean, this is a very grimy West.
It is grimy.
Everything feels a lot dirtier. Everyone's soaked in sweat and
dirt. It is really a stylized grime to a certain extent. It's not really realism.
Yeah, it's very different from
Unforgiven to realism.
Yeah.
Grimy.
Yeah, like that is like everything is gray and like, but this one the colors are still pretty bright. Yeah. And then again, there's that operatic style music that, you know, Unforgiven was like the West without the bravado. Mm-hmm. Like everyone was very reluctant to kill each other. This is like the complete opposite of that.
It's all bravado.
It's bravado.
Is there a character that's not some sort of bravado?
Probably not.
Everyone's just a little more than a normal person.
I mean, there are different levels of it.
You know,
the younger brother of the one gang is probably the one who we said was kind of a salacious crumb.
Yeah.
You Star Wars fans will get that reference.
He was just laughing over. it was kind of unnerving, actually, in that one scene.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that reminds me of, what one of my problems a little bit. It was interesting. This was a movie that, again, kind of the opposite of Unforgiven. I was really enjoying it through most of it until toward the last, I don't know.
Is it right before the finale?
Yeah, kind of right before the finale. So I was like, this feels a little dark. And then afterwards, I was like, I felt a little grimier at the end of it.
Yeah.
And I remember, which is interesting because this is rated R for violence, but the violence is mainly due to a body count.
Yeah, no blood, there's no gore, there's not even...
Like, the blood level is nothing, like, different from, like, say, an Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no nudity, there's not really even language, at least in the English translation of it. It's really just the body count, which is probably the more shocking thing, I'm guessing, in 1964.
And there's the one scene that really solidifies, like, our hatred of the one gang, which was already the worst gang there was, but they just basically do this massacre. And it's dragged out.
It is, and it feels like you're also supposed to exult in the slaughter for a little while. I mean, you're not, I don't think, but like the amount of time they spend on it, and you get to see the, you know, they're gunning down people who are running out of a burning building.
Yeah,
like, ugh.
And they do it for a little bit, like, okay, that's bad, and then it goes on for like for everybody to come out the building.
Yeah, and it's one of these things I was wondering, was like, I'd be tempted to dismiss this as sort of a style over substance sort of thing, except I was like, but there's a reason this must have stuck around in people's minds. There's something that here that people gravitated to, that it defined a whole genre around this stuff. And if that's the case, I'm like, because it makes me think of, again, being very like, we're not worried about morals here. That's kind of the not important thing here. It's more about the style, the attitude of the man with no name, this punk star that, like, we're not going to even worry about pretending that this is all about something noble. It's like, we just are here to give you guys some good gun-toting action.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's kind of missing the point of what we actually like about Westerns.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it, because, like I said, I enjoyed it while watching it, but then afterwards I was like,
No one ever comes here to play. We spend our time here between funerals and burials.
Yeah, never saw a town as dead as this one.
You will never see another like it.
What's wrong with the place?
We've had too many killings. You have seen the women? None of them are women, they're widows. The place has only widows. Here you can only gain respect by killing other men, so nobody works anymore.
I can see that. Like, I wasn't sure what I completely felt, because it didn't leave me as like, like, there are parts I really enjoyed, and there's other parts of, like, morally, what do I feel about all this stuff? is interesting because I do like some of the justice stuff, but it is a very grimy, gritty, like no one's good sort of justice.
Yeah.
And I guess I was trying to compare it to something else. And I guess I compared it sort of like a, like Samson. Like Samson's not a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
But God used him to get justice on this worst people. And I feel sure. like this, or like the way the Old Testament prophets talk about Babylon, like, hey, Babylon, you're going to do this horrible and then I'm going to have to punish you, but I'm going to use you first.
Yeah.
And, then I'm going to and I felt like everyone involved was sort of like that. Like almost like the one gang was used to punish the other one and then Clint Eastwood used to punish them.
Yeah.
But then I'm not sure what to make of him.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Apparently there was, when this was shown on TV in 1975, they actually filmed a new intro for it using stock footage of Clint Eastwood. He wasn't actually involved, but basically it was this, I think, U.S. government guy basically giving the man with no name a mission to take out these two rival gangs in order to earn a pardon.
Oh, really?
Like they wanted to give a better justification for why he did all this. And I guess that would make the violence a little bit more acceptable for television.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which is fascinating to think, like, some people would say, ah, you're just trying to sugarcoat something. And like, nah, forget it. Just, it's all about the id of it at the yeah. moment, the like reveling in the violence. But I think the people who want to have, like, no, we're not reveling in violence for violence sakes. It should mean something.
Yeah. Like, justice might be brutal, but we want it still to be justice, mm-hmm. at least. And the brutality, we can argue, should be that much. But if it's just revenge, it's different.
Yeah.
I feel like if the burning scene, if it has any purpose just to make it so that at the end you're like, but we already knew they were bad, so I'm not yeah. sure we need that much of it.
I mean, maybe part of the problem is we don't know as much about the other family.
That's true.
Like if they established more of how bad they were too, then it'd be like, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like that's something that's a little missing. Well, that's time already.
All right. So yeah, that's us. Yeah, it's a little complicated.
It is a little complicated. There's no question in my mind why this is considered a classic
no.
or like a genre-defining thing. It definitely has its own feel. It's very different
and
from what Westerns
very,
were.
I'm glad to have watched it, and much of it was, if not entertaining, was at least interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've said before that there was a period of time when Westerns were like a quarter of Hollywood Studios'
yeah.
output. We're getting into the era now where they probably were looking for fresh blood, and Sergio Leone provided
yeah.
it, for better or for worse. But yeah, like I said, some mixed feelings, but it is an interesting experience for sure.
So would you recommend it to the casual movie fan?
I think if you're old enough, I would not, even though, like I said, the violence is not super, it's mainly because of the body count. It's not because of something horrific.
But there is some grittiness just about the whole entire setup.
Yeah. For that reason, I would still not recommend it for younger viewers.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Even though it's a light R, I would still steer them away from that. Like, again, there's better, more morally uplifting. Man, that makes me sound really like a stick in the mud. But
no, but like, if you wanted the mysterious man coming to help town, Shane's, everyone can watch.
Shane's a much better one to approach.
This is a very interesting, again, stylized version, but it is a little more mature.
Yeah, I would concur with that.
And then someday we'll have to compare it more to Unforgiven, but we only had 12.
We only had 12 minutes. I really do feel like Unforgiven is a commentary on the
style almost.
The style almost, kind of a, all right, we went this far. Now let's kind of pull it back and find a new middle ground.
And find like, well, okay, what would this actually look like in real life?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, Tim, I guess that's it. Next time, we will be 1974, and we'll be watching
Chinatown, which I expect is another R-rated movie. So I'm afraid
we'll
see
what happened.
We're in that part of the season, folks. We got a couple R-rated movies in a row.
Every once in a while, they're really good, and every once in a while, you're like, "Oh, this is Gangs of New York."
but this one has long been lauded. The script, especially, has long been lauded in the film community. So yeah. We will see.
Remember, if you would like to listen to this podcast or our Mothership podcast or even Weekly Hijack, you can visit our website at derailtrainsofthought.com.
Where we have all of our podcasts. Now, currently as we record this, there's we've got a problem with the hosting.
Some of the old ones are, we still have them, like the connections are broken and the links, and you may not be able to listen to those until I get that fixed.
Yeah, that really only affects the Derailed Trains of Thought and the Weekly Hijack.
And the older stuff.
Yeah, the much older stuff from like before we moved everything onto this website.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect this podcast, Let's Finally Watch This. So if you want to go back and listen to our episodes on Unforgiven or Shane,
yep,
the two previous big Westerns, I guess we also covered The Great Train Robbery, which is nominally a Western. But if you want to listen to those are still available, and I would encourage you to check them out if you haven't yet.
Until next time, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.